Barack Obama has some words of advice about the flu.
Stay home if you're sick. Wash your hands frequently. Cover your sneezes with your sleeve, not your hands.
So I guess everything we need to know about H1N1 we learned in kindergarten.
Come on, wash with Elmo. Wash, wash, wash.
And when you have to sneeze or cough, do it into the bend of your arm.
Oh, sneeze into your arm with Elmo. Achoo.
Great job.
Oh, Elmo feels a real sneeze.
Achoo! Excuse me on the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone, and
everyone.
God bless you. Good morning.
Absolutely.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's Wednesday, September 2nd. I'm John Huckenberry, joined by a wet-sleeved Celeste Headley. Good morning, Celeste.
At least it's my sleeve and not my hand,
right? Very good. Elmo would be very proud
of you.
Coming up this hour, car sales from last month show they were great for some companies and not so great for others. Who's the clunker in the auto industry? We'll find out. Gmail was out yesterday for about an hour. Did you survive? And we're going to take a look at differences between our healthcare system and those used in Canada and Europe.
But first, let's talk about the H1N virus with Dr. Richard Wenzel, former president of the International Society for Infectious Diseases. Dr. Wenzel, what's your best piece of advice to avoid getting swine flu?
Well, I think from the beginning, from the public health perspective, obviously the best first step would be to accept the vaccine. And the pregnant people, obese people are extremely high risk for severe disease. They ought to be first in line. Second, obviously, hand washing. This virus can get on the hands. And you don't want to touch your eye, your nose, your mouth, where you will infect yourself if you happen to pick it up from the environment. And I think we ought to consider something else. Stop shaking hands during the flu epidemic.
Oh, no. We have to stop shaking hands with people? What will we do when we say hello?
I think you're going to knock elbows or just raise
fists.
Your hand up in the air.
Hugs are out. Hugs are out.
Hugging is safer.
Richard Wenzel, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
There's a headline. Hugging is safer. Afghanistan's deputy chief of intelligence has been killed in a suicide bombing east of Kabul. More than 20 others also died in the blast, including two top provincial officials. That comes as the United Nations releases a report stating that Afghanistan's opium production fell 10% last year. Poppy cultivation is down more than 20%. The report states that Afghanistan has been producing more opium than the world is demanding, which could be behind the drop in production.
Here in the U.S., humidity and a break in the intense heat have helped firefighters battle a blaze north of Los Angeles, but fire officials say winds could fuel the blaze later today. Heavy rain and strong winds may have hit towns on Mexico's west coast ahead of the expected arrival of Hurricane Ximena. The storm has weakened, though, to a Category 2 hurricane.
After a sell-off yesterday, the Dow kicks off today at 93.11, the S&P opens at 9.98, and the NASDAQ starts trading at 19.69. Futures suggest a flat to negative opening when Wall Street gets going. What are you doing differently to protect yourself from H1N1?
My name's Mary Pat, and I will be giving my daughter a lot more cinnamon in her food. It's antiviral, and looking for other spices and vitamins that will help boost her immune system.
Concrete advice to protect yourself against H1N1. That's
delicious
what we're looking
advice.
For from you. 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. More advice coming up.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headley, and we washed our hands before we came into the studio this morning.
And I didn't shake your hand.
Excellent, excellent. And, you know, we're told by the World Health Organization that we are technically in a pandemic as far as H1N1
right now.
Is concerned. But, you know, listening yesterday to President Obama lay out his rules for fighting H1N1 this fall, it sounded a little business as usual.
Stay home if you're sick. Wash your hands frequently. Cover your sneezes with your sleeve, not your hands, and take all the necessary precautions to stay healthy.
And Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said this on NBC's Today Show this morning.
We know that we're going to have a big influx of flu cases, and we're going to, in all likelihood, have them before the vaccine is ready.
So the vaccine's going to be late. There's going to be a big influx. We should brace for it. Well, hand washing, that's one theme. But I also detect the theme of isolation. Stay home if you show symptoms, if you're sick. Welcoming back Dr. Richard Wenzel, the immediate past president of the International Society for Infectious Diseases and chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University. So the vaccine's going to be late. And if you're suspecting that you're sick, you're supposed to stay home. How typically does that sort of isolation strategy work, and how do you implement something like that?
Well, I think it's going to be complicated because there are a lot of conflicts. Remember that adults shed this virus, any flu virus, for 6 or 7 days. But the stresses to stay away from work in this tough economy is going to be enormous. And students who are in college, for example, trying to get an A grade so they can get into grad school or be at the top of the class, if they start feeling well after 2 days, it's going to be almost impossible to get them to stay away from school.
Well, it's the federal recommendation is 3 to 5 days is what you should take off if you feel that you're symptomatic. You're suggesting that isn't even enough.
From an epidemiologic point of view, that's a little short because, again, we have this long shedding period. And for children, kids who get influenza can shed the virus for weeks, sometimes 2 to 3 weeks. So, again, with mom wanting to get back to work, it's hard to believe they'll keep a child home for 2 weeks instead of sending him or her back to daycare.
Well, it sounds like your suspicion here is that Americans aren't inclined to take this terribly seriously based on what's coming out of the White House and your anticipated response that people are probably not going to, you know, take time off of work.
Well, I don't think, even if they take it seriously, I think there's so many social and economic pressures that it's going to be difficult. On the other hand, there is a little complacency in the United States compared to what this virus has been shown to do in Latin America, where I've visited a couple of times in 5 countries. There, when you see young 20-, 30-year-old, 40-year-olds on respirators, and you see what this virus is capable of doing, you have to say, so far, maybe we've been lucky in the United States, but we cannot be complacent.
How do you put Americans on a footing where if they were to show up at the workplace with a mask on their face, and the CDC does suggest that one type of mask would be appropriate, that they don't get laughed out of the office?
Well, there's always going to be humor in the office, so I don't think we'll probably stop that. But I think we have to just continue to educate people that all flu is serious. Even seasonal flu kills 36,000 Americans a year. And then we add the potential of another flu with a different age group at risk, young adults rather than the very old, infirmed 80-year-olds that have underlying heart and lung disease. So we have the potential, at least, of seeing more Americans with more influenza and potentially more serious disease.
Finally, Dr. Wenzel, and you know, you're past president of the International Society for Infectious Diseases. I mean, you're the expert here. If someone is in a high-risk group, pregnant woman, a young, obese person, and you've seen the people who have been most seriously affected by H1N1, what can they do to isolate themselves to make themselves less vulnerable?
Well, there's no question that they're at high risk, and they should be first in line for the vaccine, first certainly. They should wash their hands, stop handshaking with other people. And if they get exposed to somebody with influenza, go ahead and take the oseltamivir, the Tamiflu, prophylactically. It's an excellent prophylactic drug. It appears to be safe in pregnancy, and it's much safer for them than getting influenza.
All right, Dr. Richard Wenzel, immediate past president of the International Society for Infectious Diseases, chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University. Thanks, as always, for helping us with that very well-informed advice.
Andrew Foster, not really shaking hands with people hardly anymore, not even really wanting to hold hands in prayer. And if I do so, I'm usually going to the bathroom.
People are giving us their advice for dealing with H1N1 at 877-8-MY-TAKE and mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Well, you know, we just heard him say that 3 to 5 days, which is what the CDC recommends, is not long enough. But, you know, John, we also heard him say that it's going to get difficult to get people to stay home for 1 day as soon as they feel better. And, you know, the facts are we have Robin Kerner here. She's a clinical psychologist at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital in New York City. She's here to help explain why we won't stay home from work. But, you know, there's some pretty serious facts involved here. 71% of Americans admit in a recent study that they go to work when they're sick because they're either A, afraid of losing their jobs, or B, they feel like they're too busy and they'll fall behind. And we also have 57 million working Americans who don't have paid sick days. So, Robin,
they can't even take a sick day.
That's exactly where they do, but they'll be unpaid. So, Robin Kerner, you're a clinical psychologist. What's beyond here? Is it truly just unfounded anxiety that's keeping people going to work when they're ill?
Well, you're talking about two different cultures. We have the corporate culture, which is the external. We have companies not giving people time off. You know, about half of the companies that we work for don't give us any sick time. But then we also have those of us who have sick time aren't even taking it. On average, we don't even take 3 days.
You get paid sick time, so why aren't we taking it?
Well, we look at our work ethic. Where does that come from? So for many of us, we get that at a very young age. You know, we look at our parents. How are our parents working? You know, do we have the workaholic father typically? And then what do we do in response? Response to that? Do we become a workaholic? Do we become, you know, lazy and take the other extreme? You know, how are we going to deal with that?
You know, Wenzel was also talking about people getting back to school in the fall. That's the time when you really want to bear down. That's when people take exams. There's a report out of Emory University that 50 kids have been isolated to a dorm right at the beginning of school.
To them, yeah.
Well, lucky them, getting their food delivered. But more seriously, the question is, you know, what is driving us? Why are we working like this? You know, is it for the money? Is it for social connection? A lot of us, our only social connections are at the office, and we need that kind of contact with other people. So if we're not going to get it in our personal life, we're going to go to work. You know, when there's an emergency going on, for instance, you know, if there were a flu pandemic of some sort, you know, telling people to isolate is sort of the opposite psychological thing that you want to be doing. It's a little bit of an oxymoron here.
But you know, there are things which are emotionally traumatic. Maybe you're afraid of snakes, but that doesn't cause more epidemiological problems.
Right,
I mean,
right.
We're talking about something which could actually help spread H1N1 simply because people either, A, their kids won't stay home from school and they won't stay home from work.
Right.
So it could
seriously... Well, it's hard for the kids to stay at home from school if you don't have time off to take care of them.
Right.
You know, and a lot of this breeds itself. If you work in an office where the culture is come to work sick, you know, prove that you're the hardest working person here, and you get praised for that and even, you know, rewarded financially and bonused for how hard you're working and for perfect attendance. I think we've all seen that advertised at some companies. You know, that's not going to be an office culture where people are going to feel like it's okay to take the day off. And there is the reality right now with the economy that people fear that if I'm not indispensable, if they can manage for a week without me, I'm not going to have a job next week.
Well, here's a work culture question. If you wear a mask to work, are you insulting all of your coworkers?
I don't think so. You know, I think that that would be a respectful thing to do. If the government is telling me that I need to wear a mask, and also if my boss, if my leadership, you know, this starts from above. So, you know, what are the people who lead the organizations doing? You know, are they wearing their masks?
So if a boss says, listen, sends out an all-company email saying, listen, everyone, it's perfectly okay to wear a mask. Friday will be mask day. and everyone, please, if you're sick, stay home. Are people really going to take that seriously, that kind of thing?
No, because a lot of people are still in denial, you know, as Dr. Wenzel said, about the seriousness of this illness. You know, Americans do tend to be more complacent, and it's not until they start seeing the horrible pictures on the news and all the terrible stories that they're possibly going to wake up and pay attention to those.
Well, maybe that's the problem. The prescriptions from the federal government and the CDC aren't definitive. Maybe they should say, you must stay home. That would give the bosses and the corporate culture license to basically implement something that's likely to work. What we're describing here is never going to work.
Well, that potentially would help because that would put external pressure on us internally. I mean, there would still be this internal psychological struggle, you know, about what am I going to do if I don't go to work?
Thank you, Robin Kerner. She's a clinical psychologist at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital in New York City.
I think I'll just take 2 weeks off, just in case, you know?
Preventative.
Right, starting now.
Vacation.
Starting now.
Sick days, I should say.
If you think I should take 2 weeks off, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. What other advice do you have for guarding against H1N1?
This is Christopher Robbins calling from Austin, Texas. I have 2 children in school. From my perspective, the threat of H1N1 flu to the general population seems a bit overstated. The mortality rates seem to be lower than regular flu, and I don't expect to do anything more than I normally would to protect myself from illness.
Intelligent precautions are just hype. Share yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley. Well, we got the auto industry sales figures for August. They came out yesterday, and they show some pretty good news, John. Good news And unfortunately, bad news also.
Have you driven a Ford lately?
Well, clearly a lot of people are who never did before. Indeed. We're going to take a look at which automakers won out in the Cash for Clunkers program. We're here with Nick Bunkley. Nick is an auto industry reporter for our partners, the New York Times. He joins us from good old Detroit. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
So we got some good news out of the Cash for Clunkers program. I assume that at this point we are labeling Ford a big winner.
Ford definitely came out of this, I think, better than a lot of people had anticipated. And even Ford said that yesterday. They realized that after what everyone has gone through in the last couple of years, that anything like that is a little bit of a surprise in a lot of people's minds.
Well, they had the largest bump in their percentage rise when we're comparing August to August.
And actually, 17% up.
That's 17%, and that's larger than even the Asian automakers. And you know, Nick, it's important to put this in context to compare to last August, because isn't August generally the briskest month for auto sales every year?
It's definitely one of, although the way that things have been going lately, it's hard to really put much of a label on any particular month anymore.
So we have Ford coming out big, but unfortunately, two of the companies that were in bankruptcy earlier this year, that would be GM and Chrysler, we'd assume they'd need the most help from the Cash for Clunkers program. They didn't come out quite so well.
Sure. Well, GM and Chrysler, they ended up, of course, on the negative side the most here. For GM, it's a little bit of a mixed bag, because they will point out that they had a really good August last year, because it was their 100th anniversary and they had a big sale. To be fair, they certainly would have had a hard time matching that anyway. But Chrysler, of course, they just don't have the smaller cars out there that people really wanted to get into through this program, and so they were having just another tough month there.
It didn't surprise me that we saw a lot of small cars leaving the lots, because that was what was incentivized through the Cash for Clunkers program. What surprised me in the numbers yesterday is that we also saw a rise in the sales of Ford F-150s. It's been a while since we've seen that, right?
Those are the pickup trucks.
Large pickup trucks.
Yeah, definitely. It's the first sales increase for the F-series since October 2006, Ford said.
So what does that mean?
Well, Ford thinks that is a good sign just for the broader economy, contractors are one of the groups of people that tend to buy those types of pickups. And so when sales start to go back up with a vehicle like that, they think it shows that construction and housing maybe are starting to come back. It was the highest amount of F-Series sales in over a year.
Okay, briefly, Nick, one of the GM officials actually says he thinks the economy is coming back quickly. Do you agree? Is these auto sales evidence?
There are certainly some signs in these numbers. At the same time, the Clunkers program was such an overwhelming force in this month's sales that it's a little bit hard to see what's going on there. They're expecting sales to drop off at least pretty much through September, are going to be back sort of at the levels we saw before this. But then the rest of the year may be a better indication as to whether things actually have improved.
Okay, Nick Bunkley writes about the auto industry for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
So back during the duck and cover Cold War days, when I was growing up in the 60s, you turn on the TV and there was nothing there, you'd assume there'd been an attack of some kind, right?
Holy cow.
If you pick up your phone and there's no dial tone, you go, oh my God, what's going on? The whole fabric of the universe seems to be disrupted in some way. Well, yesterday for about an hour, people couldn't use their email on Google, and Gmail was down. The chat was down for about an hour. Google, of course, does a lot of its features in the so-called cloud configuration. That means the computers are off-site. They're not on your screen, but all of your data is stored on computers that are off in the ether somewhere. John Abel joins us now, New York Bureau Chief of Wired.com. John, good morning.
Good morning.
Is a Google outage beginning to look a lot like sort of the phone company going down during the 60s, in the sense that Google, with all of its proliferation of features and its use of cloud computing where the data is stored off your own computer, is it becoming a kind of Uber utility of the 21st century?
Well, they're certainly getting there, and I think they'd like you to think so. In fact, they have a recent ad campaign in which they say that you don't really need Microsoft products on your computer anymore because they replicate everything on their cloud. So, yeah, it's a pretty big deal when this happens. It was only for about 100 minutes, and they were pretty responsive in how they fixed the problem, so it wasn't the end of the world, but it certainly seems like that sometimes.
Well, it's a hint of things to come. Let's listen to that ad campaign that you just talked about.
Google Apps is a customizable package of workplace applications, and the communications hub is Gmail, our web-based email program. Let's explore some unique features that make Gmail users more connected, efficient, and productive.
The geeky, friendly voice encouraging you to acquire all of these apps and to actually join the Google universe. Are we ultimately unclear about the vulnerability of cloud computing based on Google's experience yesterday?
I think anyone in the business who would say in a cage fight would Google and Microsoft be equal partners in the reliability contest, you'd have a laughing match. Because everything to some extent is unreliable. The complexity here is that when the difficulty happens, it's not something that your own IT professionals can deal with. You have to wait for people that are far away generally and completely off limits to you to deal with the problem. So what Google and other companies that are involved in cloud computing have to convince us is that they are responsive and they can fix these problems quickly without you calling up tech support and waiting and asking and waiting to be asked, is the machine plugged in and turned on?
Well, indeed. What sells the Google apps is their transparency, but when they go down, you're just out of luck. John Abel, New York Bureau Chief of Wired.com, thanks so much. Now we're looking at some headlines in the news this morning.
Hurricane Ximena was downgraded to a Category 2 storm as it reached the coast of Mexico's Baja Peninsula. The National Hurricane Center expects the storm to weaken even further. Four members of Iraq's security forces were sentenced to death for their roles in a bank heist that left eight bank guards dead. The gunmen stole the equivalent of around $4.8 million from a bank in the Iraqi capital. Officials say at least 15 people are dead after a powerful earthquake struck Indonesia today. The U.S. Geological Survey measured the quake at 7.0 magnitude.
Those two American reporters, Laura Lee and Yuna Ling, who were imprisoned in North Korea for 4.5 months, have written about their experience. It's on the Current TV website. The journalists say they never intended to cross a frozen river into North Korea. The reporters were pardoned last month. Oil prices recovering after a two-day dip. They lost $2 yesterday, trading around $69 a barrel this morning. Those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
Wildfires ripping through Southern California. We'll talk with one of the fire's victims coming up in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. So we've discovered that the fire in Southern California, the one that's just north of Los Angeles, is now more than 20% contained, but it is still burning pretty high. And we have someone with us, Sylvia Avanesian, and she's just one of thousands of people who've been affected by the fire. She's a recent UCLA graduate. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning.
You were evacuated from your home last Friday, and now you're back into your house. Are you there to stay?
Correct, yes. We've been evacuated for days now, and today was the first day that we got to go back to our homes.
But is there a chance you will be evacuated again?
You know, it doesn't look like it. Looks like everything up in our hill has been burnt down, so there isn't much to be, you know, catch on fire, but you never know. There are a few hot spots around the hills.
Everything's been burnt. That's not a pleasant thought.
No.
You've lived in the area for 20 years, and I myself grew up in Southern California. I know that when you grow up in that area, you live with wildfire. But have you ever experienced anything quite like this fire before?
Never. Past 50 years, this has been one of the biggest fires that we've ever experienced here.
So what makes it different? What is it about this fire that makes it worse for you?
I mean, you never know what's going to happen because these fires can be really tricky. I mean, I've seen it all come down the hill, and you think it'd be like burning away 1 minute. Next thing you know, another tree would catch on fire. Next thing you know, like the fire will escalate, coming down quickly, and you see it all burn down right in front of your eyes.
How close did it get to your neighborhood?
Oh, I mean, my next door neighbor's backyard is basically in one of the big hills, and his backyard basically caught on fire, but the firefighters did a great job for saving his house, so right next door.
So you're back in your home, but you still had your home packed up, and you're going to remain that way? Are you going to stay in kind of alert mode?
Still in an alert mode. The fire hasn't stopped yet, and, you know, we don't feel too safe right now in packing. You know, everybody has their things still packed up, ready to go. So, yeah, everything's still in my car.
Okay, Sylvia Avanesian, good luck. I hope the fire stays well away from your home.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
22% contained doesn't sound like much.
But it's a lot better than 5%, which is where they were yesterday morning.
No, it's still burning there in Southern California. Well, we had an object lesson yesterday on The Takeaway of why this healthcare debate is so frustrating and why it can really be difficult to pin down what's actually going on in the healthcare debate. First of all, we talked to a woman by the name of Lori Roman, who's the founder of Regular Folks United. It's an online forum featuring right-leaning bloggers on healthcare. But she told us in her experience of dealing with her insurance company that when a bone-eating tumor was discovered in her son's leg, he got prompt and excellent care here in the United States, and she made a comparison.
My son's leg probably would have not been saved in Great Britain, according to everything that I've seen from statistics and data and my friends' advice. And also, I have friends from Canada who said the same thing. My son's leg would not have been saved in Canada.
Well, that comment drew a lot of listener responses on our website. Nicole wrote on our site at thetakeaway.org, "I'm sorry for the loss of Lori's father, and I'm very happy that her son could be saved with their excellent coverage. I just hope that the healthcare system is fixed before he grows up and needs to find health insurance with a history of aggressive bone-eating tumors in his background. But if Lori wants to remain credible," Nicole writes, "she should abstain from making statements that her son would not have been saved in Great Britain or Canada. This debate needs to be tied to the facts." Well, let's take a closer look. What is the truth in this comparison with Canada and Great Britain that was made yesterday by Lori on our program? Uwe Reinhardt joins us, a professor of economics and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. Professor, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, let's just give you the straight facts. If there was an aggressive bone-eating tumor diagnosed in one of your loved ones, would there be a greater or lesser likelihood that the leg would be saved and that the life of your loved one would be saved here in the United States under a private insurer versus Canada's system or Great Britain's system?
I think in this particular case, the probabilities would probably be the same. In fact, even within the United States, healthcare varies so enormously that it would be hard to say whether in some other state the leg would have been saved. This lady's statement is completely irresponsible because it's based on hearsay. Her friends, who are these friends? Are they bank clerks or are they physicians? I mean, how low can the debate on healthcare actually sink if that is taken as a data point?
Well, why would she have this impression, or do you think that she's just trying to get an ideology out there because she has a political stake in the matter?
First of all, she has a political stake in the matter. But take, for example, the case of Investors Daily, which is a well-known daily newspaper. They had an editorial claiming that Stephen Hawking, the famous physicist who has multiple sclerosis, and
he has ALS. He has ALS, right? Yeah,
ALS. And they claimed that in England he would have never survived. They would have written him off as worthless and let him die. Well, it turns out this gentleman is a professor at Cambridge University in England, and he wrote a little commentary saying, "I owe my life to the National Health Service in Britain." But here was the prestigious Investors Daily putting in an editorial. This woman reads that and thinks, aha, these editors must have checked the facts or know them. They didn't. The editors, in fact, never retracted their statement. They only admitted he lives in England. They have, in my view, no shame for not retracting what was absolutely an untruth.
Well, Uwe Reinhardt, professor of economics and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, thanks for that fact check. We, of course, don't know the source of Lori's information or the nature of her friends. She does believe that she had a much greater likelihood of having her son's life saved and leg saved in the United States than Great Britain or Canada. But Uwe Reinhardt says that that is an absurd assertion, that the probabilities are probably the same.
If she didn't have insurance, the leg probably wouldn't have been saved. She was lucky she wasn't short.
Uwe Reinhardt, professor of economics and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. Thanks. And now let's take a look at some of the headlines we're following this morning.
A Taliban suicide bomber detonated explosives near a mosque east of Kabul today. Officials say the attack killed the country's deputy chief of intelligence and at least 20 others. The explosion happened as government officials left the mosque there. A Taliban official says the intelligence officer was specifically targeted. Commanders in Afghanistan may ask for more troops. Wisconsin Democrat Senator Russ Feingold was on the Takeaway earlier today, but he says increased forces may not be the answer.
My view is constantly building up troops makes it harder to get the confidence of the Afghan people, and it probably helps the elements of the Taliban that are interested in harming us as well.
You can hear the full conversation with Senator Feingold at thetakeaway.org.
In Pakistan, religious affairs minister was wounded after gunmen fired on his vehicle in Islamabad. Officials say the van's driver was also killed. The minister has been critical of militants for attacks throughout the city. And a coordinated double car bombing attack in Greece outside the Athens Stock Exchange. No reported fatalities. Those are some of the top stories we're following today.
So in a little more than a week, the entire nation commemorates the anniversary of 9/11. A memorial in Pennsylvania gets underway. The one in downtown Manhattan, still not really moving. We'll find out why in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Joining us now, Frankie Nealon, mayor of Innis in Ireland. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, John. How are you?
So, Frankie, how many people yesterday in Innis claimed to be directly related to Muhammad Ali by your count?
I would say a few thousand.
A few thousand people.
We had 15,000, between 15 and 20,000 in Innis, and I think all that were present would be claiming a relationship somewhere along the line.
Well,
they
and more showed up yesterday to meet Muhammad Ali, whose great-grandfather, Abe Grady, hailed from Ennis in Ireland. And Muhammad Ali went over to visit his ancestors. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there were some relations. There was a lot of relations. He had a great day in Ennis yesterday. He was delighted. He done a lot of work for us yesterday. He returned the compliment. We invited him to Innis, and we were delighted he came. He had the most fantastic day, and so had the people of Innis.
So just
of all Ireland. We had
describe what it was like, just to take me through the day.
Well, he arrived in the civic offices approximately 1:30. He wasn't due till 2:30, so he rested for an hour. So after that, we had a civic reception, and then we presented him with the freedom of the town, approximately 3:00. After that, we had a cavalcade through the town of Innis, which arrived in the Turnpike Road, which is the road his ancestors came from. There we unveiled the plaque. He unveiled it himself. He left his jeep and walked through the people, and it was a fantastic moment when he approached a young fella in a wheelchair from County Clare, and he bent over and hugged that young fella. The people in the crowd, of all ages, there were tears in their eyes. It was the most fantastic opportunity for that young fella to meet the greatest of the greatest sportsmen ever to be on this earth.
Well, that is very, very sweet. Now, of course, the reason there is a connection between Ireland and Muhammad Ali's family is that someone there from Ennis actually had a relationship with a slave in the United States, and the name actually wasn't preserved. Does that concern you at all?
Well, there would be some concern on it, but the history of it, that's John O'Grady, who was his great-great-grandfather, left in us in 1860, and subsequently arrived in Kentucky, where he married an African-American lady, and his son also married an African-American, and their son was Cassius Clay Sr.
So, Cassius Clay Sr. Right.
That's right.
So,
and Cassius Clay was born in 1942, and, you know, subsequent to that, he changed his name to Muhammad Ali.
There you go. Well, before we go, what do you think is the most Irish about Muhammad Ali's fighting style? Is it the is it the movement, the fact that he dances around in the ring, or is it powerful right?
There's a touch of the Irish dancing, and I can tell you he has the gift of the Irish gab as well.
The bragging.
So
All right, Mayor. Thanks so much for being with us. Frankie Nealon is the mayor of Innis, Ireland, where Muhammad Ali hails from. Thank you, Mayor.
From the contender to the brawl, the ring, the rose, the matador, brave.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley. Coming up, an update on two 9/11 memorials. Pennsylvania's is on the way, but Manhattan's still delayed. More in a few minutes. As fall starts, though, we're asking you, what kind of precautions are you taking against the H1N1 virus, if you're taking any at all? What are you doing differently to protect yourself?
My name's April Harper. I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. I find it interesting that you actually think corporate America is going to say, stay home, take the time off, because I know at my company, they don't do that. Very far from that. As a matter of fact, if you are out more than 4 days, you get a letter. You get written up.
Tell us how the swine flu is changing your behavior and if you're going to be able to stay home from work, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now a look at some of the top news stories. The wildfire near Los Angeles is still burning, but firefighters are taking comfort in favorable weather. Higher humidity and lower temperatures are slowing its spread, but the fight goes on and evacuation orders still have many neighborhoods empty. And we've got a fresh economic report just out a few minutes ago. Productivity is up at the fastest pace in nearly 6 years. It grew 6.6% in the second quarter. That's as labor costs are dropping because companies have aggressively cut jobs.
So if you're laid off and cooling your heels, you're contributing to somebody's productivity increase. The UN's top nuclear watchdog says the threat of Iran's nuclear program is, quote, hyped. No hard proof that Iran is making an atomic weapon. This as top officials from six countries, including the U.S., are meeting in Europe to talk about what to do on Iran's nuclear program. President Obama starts his Labor Day vacation early. He's taking the family to Camp David later this morning for a five-day stay. Those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
So we're just over a week out from the anniversary of 9/11, and we're getting a couple updates on two large memorials that are planned. The federal government announced this week it's reached a final agreement to purchase land for a Flight 93 National Memorial in southwestern Pennsylvania. Flight 93, of course, was the aircraft that crashed in the fields there after being hijacked on 9/11. We're joined now by Patrick White. His cousin, Louis Joseph Nackey II, was a passenger on Flight 93. Patrick is a land use attorney who was involved in the negotiations there. We're also joined by Carol O'Hare. Her mother, Hilda Marson, was aboard Flight 93. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Carol, you were part of the committee that did the first round of selections for designs. Your part of the committee actually narrowed it down to five choices of designs. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what does the memorial now look like? What is it going to look like when it's finished?
Well, it's going to... we were presented with about 1,000 designs, and we chose five finalists, and then they were presented to a Stage 2 jury who chose this final design. This particular design was chosen because it fits the landscape where the plane crashed. It kind of outlines the crash area, and it also, it seemed the most fitting design for that, part of the country and that area, and that because of the cost factors and all that. And
Carol, what do you think the message is for a Flight 93 memorial that would be distinct from, say, the memorial at the Pentagon or the one at Ground Zero that's being planned in New York?
Well, I think the distinction is that we wanted to honor the actions of the passengers and crew and to make it clear that, they thwarted a further attack on our country. And although this design is not, specific to doing that, it's by a visitor center being in place, the story can be told, and that this design also includes that as part of the overall plan.
One thing that distinguishes it is that it seems as though you've had a lot less headbutting and red tape there in Pennsylvania than there's been in New York. You said that the process was relatively amicable. Patrick, you were involved in negotiations for the land itself. Why do you think things have gone forward so smoothly in Pennsylvania?
Well, I'd say that's because we've been very patient, and as well we've been very persistent. Early on, we developed a planning framework, developed a general management plan, developed the Resource Assessment Committee. So we've been very structured in the approach. We've been blessed to have some
National Park Service staff that are really excellent at what they do and have really taken to this project and become part of what we call the Flight 93 family.
And Patrick, you're also going to be taking a motorcycle ride. You're going to leave Newark, New Jersey, and travel to San Francisco, arriving there on September 11th. What's the purpose of that ride?
Purpose is to complete the flight of United Airlines Flight 93 to raise awareness for the creation of the National Memorial, and probably most important at this juncture, since we're going to have groundbreaking on November 7th of this year, is to raise funds for the actual construction of the memorial itself. And this is phase one of the project, and so we're at a point where as we go across the United States, we're going to be bringing those messages of awareness and fundraising and giving people as well an opportunity to put tributes on a traveling temporary memorial that's very much like that at the temporary memorial in Shanksville, so that they can themselves interface with not only us as family members, but also the idea that for people who can't travel the distance to the memorial, that we're bringing it to them.
The memorial is going to cost $58 million. It's 2,200 acres. So does this, the size and the cost, I mean, does it, this large project, does it end up in the end helping you with the grieving process of getting over what happened?
I think each day that is part of the onion that's peeled back, it's a different process and a different rate for each of the family members. I wouldn't say that in all instances participation is something that heals, but I believe that the memorial will. And so achieving its end is the key thing for us. And as far as that acreage, I keep hearing it, but I sent an email yesterday saying, can't we just get the right number out there? Isn't it actually that the park itself, rather than the buffering easements to protect the view?
Okay.
The actual park itself is probably closer to 1,600 to 1,800.
Okay, that's still pretty large. Matthew Sherman is here. He's a reporter for WNYC Radio in New York. And Matthew, you've been listening to this conversation with the folks from Pennsylvania, and that sounds like a pretty amicable, smooth process there, and that's not what we're seeing here in New York.
That's true, although at the same time, at this point in the process in New York, hopefully we've all resolved our differences when it comes to the memorial part of it. And it's interesting to hear some of the numbers out there, $58 million, 2,200 acres for the Shanksville Memorial, or 1,600 as it may be. We're talking about a memorial in New York City that's going to cost 10 times that amount and yet be put on just 8 acres. So we're talking about a lot more money, a lot smaller space, a lot more
higher priced real estate.
Actually, the real estate was not the issue here in New York, because the government owned this property.
Indeed.
It's taken so long to get to this point, and the construction is already underway. It's been underway for about 2 years. About 80% of it will be done and open on the 10th anniversary. The real problem has been raising that money, and simply the construction muscle to get this pit dug, the bathtub sealed, and all the other components that are going to be squeezed onto this site.
The bathtub is the engineering reference to the landfill that actually keeps the Hudson River out.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Matt Sherman, you've been covering this for our partner, the WNYC, since the beginning. So we've had a number of timelines change. They keep announcing a date at which certain things are going to be completed and then changing it and saying, well, this is our date when it's going to be completed, but the real date when it's reasonable for us to expect to be completed is actually 2 years later. So do we have any idea when we're going to see some results here?
Well, they really want to stick to this idea of opening the memorial on the 10th anniversary, opening, in this case, being 80% open.
Opening what?
The plaza. That is this 8-acre plaza. Most of it, except for one corner, will be open. Trees will be planted. The reflecting pools and the waterfalls that mark the footprints of the original Twin Towers, all that will be operating and open on the 10th anniversary. The museum will take another year, and some areas will be closed in the following months and years because of all all that else is going on this
side. Well, let's hope the red tape is over in New York, as it seems to be in Pennsylvania. Matthew Sherman reports for our partner WNYC. We're also joined by Carol O'Hare and Patrick White. They both lost loved ones on Flight 93 on September 11th.
So we've been getting advice from you on precautions to guard against H1N1. The president says one of the things you should do is take up to 5 days off of work if you get sick. But the pressure is pretty intense.
My name is Heather, and I'm from Allen Park, Michigan. And I think the recommendations to stay home are unrealistic. In October, I will be having a baby, and I will be staying home. But if my husband were to get sick, we would have no income whatsoever. We have no benefits like paid time off or sick days or anything like that.
The pressure is intense. Here's your takeaway.
There is the reality right now with the economy that people fear that if I'm not indispensable, if they can manage for a week without me, I'm not going to have a job next week.
That's Robin Kerner, clinical psychologist at St. Luke's Roosevelt. Take time off. What do you do to prepare for H1N1? 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
This is The Takeaway. Dipping approval ratings, you might say someone is having the president for lunch. Say, President Truman.
Hello? Or is this Harry Truman talking?
Yes, sir, Mr. President. How are you? Lyndon Johnson.
Well, my goodness alive, Mr.
I'm mighty glad to hear your voice.
I thought maybe if this was convenient to you after lunch, I'd like to come over and pay a call.
Why don't you come and have lunch with me?
Oh, my goodness alive.
Come over here about 1:30 and you come and eat with us, and I'll give you a snort or two, but I won't put you on a helicopter.
All right.
You know, the Democrats have been trying to reform health care since the Harry Truman administration, giving the Obama administration a few good snorts. Obama already said no to the new helicopters, right? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Oh, man, listen to Truman and Johnson. Those were the days. Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 2nd. I'm John Hockenberry, joined by Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Oh, my goodness, John. It's good to see you. Coming up this hour, a new study on workplace violations is being released today. We'll talk with one of the authors. We'll also talk about Afghanistan with Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold. And we're talking all this week about New Orleans 4 years after Katrina. We'll take a look at how restaurants are doing.
The restaurants, yes. National treasures, them all. But first, Alex Burns joins us, White House reporter for Politico. Alex, with these sagging approval ratings for Obama, would you say that the president's bully pulpit is looking a little more like a seat in the bleachers?
Well, John, that's exactly what a lot of Democrats have been frustrated with Obama about, that he hasn't necessarily been using his bully pulpit as aggressively on health care as they'd like him to. What we're hearing down in Washington is that it sounds like the president is going to step it up a little bit, make his case more aggressively in the coming weeks.
Well, we'll see what happens this week. Stay with us, Alex. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about those sagging approval ratings. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In Afghanistan, a top government official is dead after a suicide bombing east of Kabul. More than 20 others also died in the blast, including two top provincial officials and a number of civilians. Meanwhile, a new report from the UN states that Afghanistan's opium production fell 10% last year. Poppy cultivation is down more than 20%. However, world heroin prices are low, so some analysts suggest that opium suppliers may be depleting stockpiles in order to boost prices.
Here in the U.S., a new report, economic data just out this morning, worker productivity grew at its fastest pace in nearly 6 years during the second quarter, but it's another sign that people are losing their jobs, fewer people working more. In California, humidity and a break in the intense heat have helped firefighters battle that massive blaze north of Los Angeles, but fire officials say winds could fuel the blaze later today. In the Pacific, Hurricane Ximena has weakened to a Category 2 storm. The National Hurricane Center says the storm is expected to continue weakening before hitting land. In Wall Street, all major indices went down more than 2% yesterday. The Dow starts at 93.11, the S&P opens at 9.98, and the Nasdaq starts trading at 19.69. What are you doing to protect yourself from H1N1? It's a question for you.
This is Arun Vadlamani. I'm calling from South Orange, New Jersey. Maybe what we could do for the time being is do what people do in India, where you fold hands and say namaste. So this way you still greet everyone you want to greet, and you don't get any flu on your hands.
We'll take lessons from anywhere and anyone. What's the swine flu doing to change your behavior? The president has some recommendations. What are yours? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'll give you a snort or two.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. And it's perhaps safe to say that Obama potentially has a problem brewing, wouldn't you say?
I think that's very safe.
Approval ratings hovering around 50%, an enormous slide from inauguration when it was way, way up there.
I think it's also safe to say that they're glad that there's going to be a break from the August break.
Yes, the president is headed to Camp David. He's going to take a long weekend up there for Labor Day, taking a look at the McChrystal report on Afghanistan, among other things, to do a little Wednesday morning quarterbacking of the president and try to give some historical context to what seems like a precipitous slide of Barack Obama's approval rating, at least at this point. Is Alex Burns back with us, White House reporter for Politico, who joins us from Washington. Alex, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Paul Starr joins us. He's a professor of sociology and public policy at Princeton University. He was a senior health policy advisor in the Clinton White House and is the author of The Social Transformation of American Medicine. Paul Starr, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you this morning.
So let's just talk straight off the top, Alex Burns. This slide in approval rating for Barack Obama, is it a function of the events that he's dealing with, or is it something about his message not getting across and the actual messenger delivering it here? Alex?
You know, John, some of this is probably just that Barack Obama had such high expectations and such inflated poll numbers to begin with that his drop has been more precipitous than we've seen from presidents in the past. Expectations kind of coming up against reality. Americans realizing that he can't be sort of the magic man that they were all hoping he could be in January. But certainly, it's easy to see how this could have been different, how those approval numbers might be very much higher than they are right now if a health care bill had been passed, as the White House originally hoped, by the beginning of August. I think Americans like to see a forward momentum from their president and from their White House, and nothing breeds approval like success.
Well, Alex Burns points out there from Politico that the expectations couldn't have been higher at inauguration time. Paul Starr, at this point in his first term, George W. Bush, after the electoral debacle in 2000, where you could probably say the expectations couldn't have been lower for the Bush first term, he had already passed No Child Left Behind, if I'm not mistaken. Are you frustrated by the pace of progress on health care, looking back at your experience in the Clinton administration versus what's going on with Obama right now?
Well, frustrated, yes, but not really surprised. Health care has never been easy to pass. Many presidents have been stymied on this issue. It's really completely in line with the entire history that there should be an intense struggle over health care reform. What's different, I think, this year is that in the past, there was mainly interest group opposition. This year, the interest groups are really not putting themselves all out to stop health care reform. It's entirely a partisan thing. There are really no constructive Republican proposals on the table. They don't really have an alternative. They have simply set out to stop whatever it is that Obama is proposing.
Alex Burns, has that worked for the GOP? And what is the president likely to do to maybe counter in the days ahead?
Well, I guess what we'll see going forward for the Republican Party is whether they've made the right bet, similar to the bet that they made on the stimulus, that Americans fundamentally aren't comfortable with the president's agenda. If, let's just say hypothetically, if a month and a half from now, a health care bill passes with little or more likely no Republican support, and it turns out to be popular, the GOP will pay a very heavy price for it. At the time, they may not realize that. That's similar to what we saw with the stimulus, where the Republican Party really cheered as the House Republican caucus voted unanimously against the stimulus. Only three Republican senators supported it in the Senate. And as it took a little while for the stimulus to really kick in, Republicans thought they were going to get a lot of mileage out of it. At this point, when you start to see economic numbers ticking up, I think Republicans have to be a little more concerned. They could suffer a similar fate on health care.
Well, let's talk about those economic numbers. I mean, you would tend to think that positive economic news would be helpful to the president, yet it doesn't seem to have cut through all of the sort of nasty debating about health care. And really, I think in some sense you could say, and here's an example, that there's been a certain amount of ambivalence and lack of clarity on even the Afghanistan war. There was a surge in troops earlier in this year, but now General McChrystal, the commander in Afghanistan, has a very critical report on the strategy. And here's Defense Secretary Robert Gates talking about basically to expect more casualties.
The fact that we're going into areas where the Taliban have basically been unchallenged for a number of years means that our casualties are going to be higher.
Paul Starr, does Barack Obama potentially have an Afghanistan problem here?
I think a lot of liberals, as well as people on the right, are uneasy about what is happening in Afghanistan, and that we may be drawn into to the mountains of Afghanistan the way we were drawn into the jungles of Vietnam. But I want to come back to the point that you made about the economy and the economic numbers picking up. Because when you look at the public opinion poll numbers, really what is driving the decline in Obama's approval is disapproval on the economy. And I think that's because people haven't seen improvements firsthand in their own lives. Wall Street can see there's a change. The economists can see things are picking up. But most people haven't seen the effects yet themselves. And I think when those effects begin to be felt, that may have a positive effect on his approval numbers.
Well, Alex Burns famously, George W. Bush at the beginning of his second term, after a decisive electoral victory, said that he had political capital and he was going to spend it. By this point in his second term, Katrina had happened and the Bush administration was basically in the tank. Is there a such thing as political capital, and do presidents have the discretion to spend it? And if so, what did Obama get for his political capital, Alex?
Well, this administration clearly believes that there is such a thing as political capital, or at the very least, they believe that there are times when a president's cachet is much stronger than at other times. They've made the bet that this president will never be as popular or as powerful or as able to accomplish his legislative agenda as he is in his first year. And so he's trying to get everything through. You know, the analogy to this president's push for health care from the Bush administration maybe would be his push to reform Social Security. But at the time, there was nothing resembling the kind of popular support for Social Security reform that there is, at least in some polls, for health care reform.
Maybe Barack Obama made his mistake not in bringing up health care, but in predicting that he'd have something passed so quickly.
Well, Paul Starr, you mentioned the Johnson administration a moment ago. What was Johnson's key to success? He, of course, had enormous clout in the Senate in the beginning of his presidency. But what was Johnson able to do to get so many complicated bills passed in the mid-60s?
Of course, he came in with an enormous landslide, huge margins in both the House and the Senate, his own personal mastery of the Senate, as you mentioned. In the case of Medicare, that legislation had already been teed up and was ready to go. It was the first item of business of the Congress in 1965. So a lot of the work had already been done. There was complete consensus about passing Medicare among Democrats. And actually, by the way, at that time, a lot of Republicans joined in. So that was a very unusual moment. It's a pretty tough standard to match.
Yeah. Well, Alex Burns, do you look for Barack Obama to embrace the public option or to dance around it as he's done in the past as we move forward on health care?
And what Politico is hearing is that he is not going to openly embrace the public option any more than he already has. You know, the president has consistently said that there has to be choice through competition, and he thinks that one good way to do that is the public option, and that's the most we're likely to hear from him. He's not going to come out and say, send me a public option or I'm not signing the bill.
So that means repetition is the strategic order of the day. Just repeat the message till it gets through. Is that going to work, Alex?
Well, it may not be exact repetition of what we've already heard. The president has, or the White House has indicated that the president is going to lay down in more specific terms what he wants in health care reform. So far, when he's gone out to these town halls, made these speeches, he's mostly been talking on the level of principles. Health care reform must accomplish cost containment, for example. I think what we can expect to hear from him going forward is a little bit more detail in terms of how he wants to do cost containment and how he wants to ensure choice through competition.
And we've talked about the Republicans may be losing on their opposition, but there's some word from the White House that they may take issue with Democrats who are not willing to pass what they can right now and block legislation unless it's complete.
Well, you certainly heard some rumbling on the left from folks who don't want to support a bill without the public option. The White House has expressed a lot of frustration with that, saying we don't understand how the public option became the sort of brass ring of the health care debate when we have much broader goals than that, is sort of their argument.
Alex Burns, White House reporter for Politico. Thanks so much. Paul Starr, you want to leave us with a final thought?
there is going to be a compromise. Unfortunately, I don't think Republicans are going to join in that compromise. I think it's going to be a compromise between conservative Democrats and liberals in the White House.
All right, well, we're going to try to scare up some rumbles from the left when Democrat Russ Feingold in the Senate joins us a little later in the hour. Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public policy at Princeton University, senior health policy advisor in the Clinton White House, and the author of The Social Transformation of American Medicine. Thanks so much. A lot of context there.
Let's check in now on today's top news stories. Officials say a suicide tech.
Hold that thought.
Hold the thought on the headlines?
Yeah.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry with Celeste Headley. A quick update now on some economic news that looks to be good news, but maybe it's better for the corporate bottom line than it is for you and me. Productivity has grown at the fastest pace in almost 6 years this spring, up 6.6%. Labor costs, meanwhile, have shown the biggest drop since the year 2000. Jack Healy, reporter for the New York Times, is looking at the numbers. Are these a sign of the recession, Jack, or great strategic thinking on the part of corporate CEOs?
Well, you know, I guess in necessity is the mother of productivity increases. You know, corporations have had to cut their bottom lines pretty drastically over the last year. And for many of them, labor costs are some of the biggest items on their budgets. So what's been happening is they've been asking more of their workers, and that's sort of part of what we see in these numbers. Like you said, you know, productivity is up by the largest percentage increase since 2003. And we're seeing that the total output from businesses has fallen a little bit, but it hasn't fallen as much as the number of hours worked. So businesses are doing a little less, but with a lot less
Hours. Thanks so much for the update. It's, in some sense, a recessionary indicator, even though it does indicate we're more competitive in productivity terms. Jack Healy is a reporter for the New York Times with an update on worker productivity, up 6.6%, according to the latest figures released at 8:30 this morning.
And there's more troubling news for workers anyway. A new study comes out today that was co-authored by advocacy groups and universities and has some pretty surprising results. We have Annetta Bernhardt. She's the policy co-director for the advocacy group National Employment Law Project. Annetta, you helped author the report that's being released today called Broken Laws, Unprotected Workers, Violations of Employment and Labor Laws in American Cities. Coming out of this report, it turns out you yourself may have been surprised by how many violations you found.
We were definitely surprised. I mean, we had already been hearing from groups on the ground, you know, that workers were coming in. They were saying they weren't being paid the minimum wage or weren't being paid overtime. The problem was that nobody had any data on it. And so we went out, we surveyed 4,000 workers last year, Chicago, New York City, L.A., and we found widespread pervasive violations. I mean, it's a pretty grim story. Lots of different types of businesses and jobs. Workers weren't being paid the minimum wage. They weren't being paid overtime.
But this study basically shows a systematic vulnerability of workers on the low end of the scale, subject to minimum wage and subject to whimsical and capricious hour regulations, and there's no oversight at all.
There's no oversight, and I think it's the systematic part that's really important. I think people tend to think of, you know, oh, this is just the informal economy, you know, it's just at the periphery, it's just a few employers. This is industry by industry. The violations were so prevalent. You know, a quarter of workers didn't get the minimum wage. More than 70% who worked overtime didn't get overtime. And, you know, a good example is actually the restaurant industry in New York City, where I think overtime has basically at this point become voluntary. And that's what advocates are telling us as well. And so the pervasiveness is really signaling this is business strategy. This is not one or two employers just deciding to break the law.
Well, we also have Amy Carroll with us. She's with a community center in Brooklyn called Make the Road New York. You're an attorney, and you represent workers who've seen these workplace violations. So why don't they say anything? If they're not getting paid minimum wage, if they're not getting paid overtime, why don't they complain?
The problem, it's industry-wide, so they think that's just what's allowed to happen. So we have restaurant workers, for example, doing deliveries. If you get deliveries in New York, there's a really high chance that your delivery worker is not being paid appropriately. Workers are working 10, 11, 12 hours a day for maybe $10 a shift, $15, $20 a shift.
$10 plus a shift, not $10 an hour.
Exactly, exactly. So their take-home pay at the end of the day is incredibly low, and the restaurants just are not paying the minimum wage or overtime to these workers despite their incredibly long hours.
Is this a legal issue, though, in the sense that in this environment, we were just talking in the last hour about people who don't take time off because they're scared for their mm-hmm. jobs. These are people, if they even raise their hand and say, what about my overtime? They're worried that they're going to get fired. In this environment, what can you do legally in a situation like that?
I mean, I think enforcement really needs to look strategically at industries, not necessarily just at single employers. So it's a partnership between government agencies like the Department of Labor that really needs to take an aggressive stance on this. Community groups like Make the Road New York, we have over 7,000 low-wage immigrant members. So it's community education about what your rights are and letting people know that they have some place to go, that we can do a protest in front of the employer, we can go to the Department of Labor and really get them the back wages that they're owed.
Annetta, she was talking about immigrant workers. Are many of these people who are afraid, are they here illegally? Do we have problems with immigration status as well?
I mean, immigration status definitely plays a role, but the big picture here is all workers are at risk.
Everyone.
I mean, whether you're U.S.-born or foreign-born, men, women, it's really across the board. And I would just add...
Well, let me just make this practical, though. I mean, okay, I raise my hand. I say, you haven't paid me for 3 weeks on overtime. I'm really mad about this. Mm-hmm. I get fired because I'm a noisy complainer worker, whatever. Do I have any recourse? Who do I call? And what's the chance I'll get my job back?
So under federal and state law, it's illegal to take a reprisal against somebody for standing up for their rights. Obviously, on the ground,
but it happens all the time.
Exactly. I mean, oftentimes we don't see workers who are willing to do anything until they've left the job, just because the reality is even one day out of work when your wages are so low can be really just terrible for your family. So I think that's why proactive enforcement by community groups, by the Department of Labor, so that restaurants, laundries, car washes know that they're going to be found out and the fines will be really high.
The problem, though, is that for the last 8 years under the Bush administration, you know, the federal Department of Labor was really dropping the ball, and I would say bordering on dereliction of duty. It was weak enforcement, ineffective enforcement. The Government Accountability Office has now issued three reports showing this. So we can't, like Amy said, we can't put the responsibility on workers to come forward when they're vulnerable. It has to be the enforcement agencies. We have to increase funding for investigators. They have to go out there on their own, get back on the ground and send the signal, you know, compliance is not optional.
Oh, it's amazing stuff. And really a big responsibility on workers there. Such an important issue. Thanks so much for coming in.
Annetta Bernhard is the policy co-director of the National Employment Law Project. She also co-authored the report being released today. It's called Broken Laws, Unprotected Workers. We also had Amy Carroll, an attorney with the advocacy group Make the Road New York in Brooklyn. We're going to check in now on some of today's top news stories. The ADP National Employment Report said employment fell by 298,000 in August. That sounds like a lot, but it's the smallest drop since September 2008. Fire officials near Los Angeles say crews are making headway in their battle against the massive Station wildfire, thanks to humidity and cooler temperatures. Hurricane Ximena has weakened to a Category 2 storm. The National Hurricane Center says the storm is expected to continue weakening gradually before hitting land. That's some of the top stories that we're watching today. Coming up
big
in
surprise.
Just a few...
Big surprise.
Coming up in
huge.
Just a
few... It's huge. What's coming up?
It is.
I'm so excited.
So I shouldn't give it away?
No, no. Please.
Russ Feingold,
yes.
Senator, joins us. He's going to be
the
talking
man.
About why we shouldn't send more troops to Afghanistan. In fact, he says we should bring them home. That's coming up in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee, and call it a message from the Taliban this morning. According to reports we're getting, the Taliban specifically targeted the chief of intelligence in Hamid Karzai's government. They got the deputy chief of intelligence in a suicide bombing. Dr. Abdullah Laghmani was one of the people killed by a suicide bomb 60 miles east of the capital. At least 20 were killed by the bomb. A message from the Taliban for U.S. policymakers in Afghanistan. We are thrilled to welcome the junior senator from Wisconsin this morning to the program, Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat from Wisconsin. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
Would you take that message from the Taliban as a sign, as some have said, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mike Mullen, that the situation is deteriorating in Afghanistan?
I don't take any messages from the Taliban. I don't think anybody else from America should. That's not our concern. Our concern is how do we stop Al-Qaeda, and whether or not what we're doing in Afghanistan by increasing troops is helping our attempt to stop Al-Qaeda or is it making it harder? My view is constantly building up troops makes it harder to get the confidence of the Afghan people, and it probably helps the elements of the Taliban that are interested in harming us as well.
You know, Al-Qaeda seems to be gone from the administration's talk about Afghanistan, lots of talk about the Taliban, and the president even referred to this war as a war of necessity. Would you agree with him on that?
Well, you know, I want to be fair to the administration. I don't think they've dropped talking about Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. There is, of course, a relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, given the events of 9/11 and obviously the connections that are continue both in the Pashtun areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan. So we can't kid ourselves on that. But I am worried that just as the president did the right thing when he came into office and started talking about the region and Pakistan and looking at the broader question, he did place the emphasis on Al-Qaeda. I don't think the huge troop buildup that he's doing, and it will apparently get worse in Afghanistan, makes it easier. I even think, and I've had this confirmed by a number of people, there's a very good chance of what we're doing is pushing more of the extremists, either Al-Qaeda or Taliban people who sympathize with Al-Qaeda, into Pakistan and strengthening what they're doing there, which is, frankly, everybody concedes, including George Will yesterday, that it's a much more critical place for us than even Afghanistan. So it's the strategy, not that the president doesn't understand the importance of trying to make sure that Al-Qaeda doesn't get back into Afghanistan in a significant way, and that the Taliban can be helpful to them. It's the strategy. I don't think the strategy of troop buildup is helping us. I think it's hurting us.
Well, let's get clear here. Are you calling for an invasion of Pakistan?
No, of course not. You know, this is the whole thing. The idea here of going after Al-Qaeda by invading countries hasn't worked very well. I mean, yes, we were able to push Al-Qaeda essentially into Pakistan by invading Afghanistan, but we didn't eliminate them. In fact, Osama bin Laden and his deputy and Mullah Omar, who was the affiliate with the Taliban in Afghanistan with Al-Qaeda, they're in Pakistan now. So invading a country is not the smart way. The smart way is the way that we got the guy who was in charge of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That wasn't through a mass troop involvement. That was through finding out where he was and specifically targeting an attack on him, not the idea of an actual occupation that was the key for that. So I agree, actually, with much of what George Will wrote yesterday. In fact, it was followed on my op-ed in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday, that there is a different way to fight a criminal syndicate like Al-Qaeda. And we're using old ideas about invasions and occupying countries to go after an organization that sometimes thrives on our doing that. We're falling into their hands. We're weakening our military. We're weakening our country's economy. That's exactly the way the Al-Qaeda would like us to proceed. So we're playing into their hands when we use this kind of a strategy. And, of course, no, I am against the idea of any kind of invasion of Pakistan. That wouldn't work either.
So are you confident that the Pakistani government is strong enough and will be cooperative enough that we can have targeted attacks in within Pakistan to get these Al-Qaeda officials?
Well, the jury is out on the Pakistan government.
Been out for 8 years, Senator.
Yeah.
The jury is out, but at least this is a civilian government. It's not Musharraf, who showed absolutely no interest in democracy. A democracy that works in Pakistan is what's necessary to get control away from the military in Pakistan and have a civilian support for stopping people like Al-Qaeda from being within their country.
All right,
I think the people of that country would like that.
If as you say, an invasion isn't going to work on Al-Qaeda and that we're, if anything, attracting or moving radicals into Pakistan, Senator Russ Feingold, what would you advise the Obama administration on a date of withdrawal from Afghanistan? When should we pull out?
Well, what I'm trying to say here is that all over the world, we are working with governments, the Indonesian government, the Malaysian government, the Indian government. We're figuring out ways in a cooperative way to go after terrorists al-Qaeda and others who may be in their midst. That's the way to do it. So when we look at this whole troop thing in Afghanistan, what I have asked for is let's have a conversation now about what kind of a time frame we could say, a flexible time frame, is likely and that we intend for Afghanistan so that the Afghan people would know, the American people would know, the people around the world would know that we don't intend an indefinite occupation of a country where we've already been for 9 years. So I think as a first step, and this is what I did with Iraq as well when I felt it was time for us to go, let's have our experts start talking about what time frame would make sense. And let's have a conversation about it. I don't claim to be the expert about exactly what the time frame should be. It has to be flexible at this point. It has to have some common sense attached to it. But it would be a very positive signal, especially if it included benchmarks, to the world and especially to the Afghan people that we are getting ready to leave at some reasonable point of time. You know, we lost over 45 Americans in Afghanistan in July. We lost even more in August, the most ever since the war began. And the situation is going to continue to get worse, and it's going to energize the elements of the Taliban that want to hurt us and hurt Afghanistan and al-Qaeda if we play into their hands and not indicate that we're not going to be stuck there forever.
Okay, Senator, quickly before we go, you've been critical about the Afghan policy of the administration. Do you think the administration has stepped away from the progressive agenda on health care as well? Perhaps Barack Obama is maybe a little too centrist for your taste?
Well, let me first say that in terms of the Afghanistan, I praise the administration for having a much better overall regional policy, including Pakistan and India. So let's be clear. It's a huge improvement over the Bush administration. I'm trying to target what I think is one mistake in the area of Afghanistan.
Gotcha.
Health care, I still don't know. I am pleased that the administration has come back to talking about a public option after slipping there. And I'm watching this very carefully because we do need a progressive health care reform bill.
Before we go, though, what are you doing to prepare for H1N1?
What am I doing personally?
Yep.
I am making sure I get inoculated from all illnesses by going to town meetings.
Share your germs with Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, talking about H1N1 and the situation in Afghanistan. He's a member of the Senate Foreign Relations and Intelligence Committee, Democrat from Wisconsin. Thank you, Senator Feingold.
We talk about food every Wednesday. Today we'll be talking about a bumper crop of fried chicken gumbo and jambalaya in New Orleans, the city's beloved restaurants.
The restaurants are back.
They are booming.
National treasures.
Talking more about that in just a few minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. Senior officials from five members of the UN Security Council, the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, and China, along with Germany, are meeting in Frankfurt today to discuss Iran's nuclear program. Their talks come just ahead of a series of international gatherings next month over whether or not they need harsher economic sanctions against Iran. Early this morning, we spoke with Jonathan Marcus. He's the diplomatic correspondent for our partners, the BBC. He joined us from London. We started by asking him about these discussions and talks and whether they're more the same or if there's something new here.
In many ways, we've been here before. In that sense, it's more of the same. I mean, essentially what the political directors, these senior officials from the foreign ministries of all of the countries concerned are trying to do is to try and assess what appetite there is for stronger sanctions against Tehran if it doesn't decide to respond to American offers to halt its enrichment activities. But I think what's interesting is there are two new factors. One new factor is that American offer. Barack Obama has reached out to the Iranians. He's given them till the middle of next month to respond in some substantive way. So that's new. The other thing, of course, that's new is the extraordinary turmoil back home in Tehran in the wake of the contested presidential election there. And of course, it's very difficult to assess how that is going to impact upon Iran's relations with the countries abroad.
Jonathan, there's one other new thing. We reported it this morning. The UN top nuclear official in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has described the nuclear threats posed by Iran as, quote, hyped. What do you make of that?
Well, if I may say, in all fairness to him, I think that is a political judgment, and I think it's equally fair that it is a political assessment where you decide Iran is heading with its nuclear activities. We all know that even the American intelligence organizations don't believe that Iran is actually working on a nuclear weapon right now. That work had been underway, and we believe, according to the National Intelligence Estimate, it had stopped some years ago. Of course, many people would say that the chief element of Iran's program program is this enrichment effort that can be used for a civil or a nuclear program. That continues. It's very clear that Iran is breaking its commitments under the non-proliferation treaty. It's breaking, it's refusing to obey the demands of the UN Security Council. So in that sense, Dr. El-Baradei, the outgoing head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, is making a judgment. That judgment, I'm sure, will be contested by at least some of the governments whose officials are meeting today.
So, Jonathan Marcus, with our partner, the BBC, we've seen in the past that China and Russia don't really have an appetite for stronger sanctions against Iran. Has that been loosening up? Is there something new in this meeting that we may see China and Russia kind of towing the line?
Well, I think that's going to be the interesting thing. I mean, we want to see what signals Beijing and Moscow are sending ahead of the UN General Assembly when we expect all of this to perhaps come to a head. I must say, at the moment, I don't think there is any great sign of attitudes changing in either Russia or indeed in China. The most recent IAEA report on Iran's nuclear activities, you know, was a kind of steady as she goes. The Iranians are building up their enrichment capacity. They're doing it slowly. But steadily. So again, you get to the political judgment. Do you sound alarm bells? Is that worrying? Or do you say, well, actually, hang on, they're not pressing ahead quite as fast as they might be. There's still time for negotiation. The other new element in this, up to a point, is an announcement from the Iranians that they have some sort of new proposal to put on the table, but it has to be substantive.
Jonathan Marcus is a diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joined us from London earlier this morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headley in with John Hockenberry. Coming up 4 years after Katrina hit New Orleans, it looks like the city's restaurants are doing better than ever. Going to talk about that during the regular interview about food that we do every Wednesday. That's in just a few minutes. Are you eating differently to prepare for H1N1? What kind of precautions are you taking? Jessica in Fanwood, New Jersey emails us, my daughter went off birth control this summer to try to get pregnant. After reading that pregnant women are a high-risk group, I called her 3 times this summer to tell her to go back on birth control until she can have a vaccination. I have no idea if she's heeding my advice, so Jessica's daughter, you might want to call your mom back. Tell us how your swine flu is changing your behavior, or maybe it's not. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or sending us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, we'll check in on some of the day's top stories. Firefighters around Los Angeles are still hearing the sound of those roaring flames, but they're starting to make gains. Lower temperature and higher humidity are helping. The blaze is now more than 20% contained. More than 30 are dead in southern Indonesia following a 7.0 magnitude earthquake. The quake collapsed several homes and buildings. Rescuers expect the death toll to rise.
The Associated Press is reporting that drug giant Pfizer is set to pay a record $2.3 billion settlement to the government. The payout is reportedly tied to illegal drug promotions. The Justice Department plans a news conference to announce the deal later today. A Baghdad court says 4 Iraqi bank robbers will die for their crimes. The gunman killed 8 guards while taking a haul worth nearly $5 million. In the emotional case, the court barred the victim's relatives from the sentencing after they beat and spat on the defendants. The World Health Organization says depression will soon be the most common illness in the world. The WHO predicts it will pass heart disease and cancer, says depression costs billions of dollars a year in treatment and lost production. Those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
Jumbo line, a crawfish pie, and a filet gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna see Mama Shazamio.
So all this week we're talking about New Orleans 4 years after Hurricane Katrina. Lots of restaurants got leveled, among other businesses, of course, during Katrina, but it looks like they are blossoming back. It looks like the business in the food business in New Orleans, at least, is booming.
The business levels
We are not at pre-Katrina levels, but we're not too far off either. Typically, the weekends, we continue to sell out.
That's the general manager of Commander's Palace, Don Strunk, in New Orleans, saying they're just getting back maybe too close to pre-Katrina levels. For more on our Wednesday food segment, we're checking in with a few of the city's restaurateurs. Carrie Seaton is the operator of Willie Mae's Scotch House, where you can get great fried chicken. And Tori McPhail is the executive chef at the city's famous Commander's Palace. Also joining us is Tom Fitzmaurice. He hosts the food show on WWL Radio in New Orleans. Tom, you've been tracking the recovery of New Orleans restaurants with a count. You've actually been counting how many have opened.
That's right. You know, just right after the storm, people started calling me and telling me, asking me, oh, how many restaurants, where are the restaurants here? And I told them there aren't any restaurants. And after a while, just so I would have something to send them, I made up a list of 22 places that I found out were open. That was really all the restaurants we had in the whole area after about a month. And I've kept up that list ever since, and we're now up to 1,032 as of this morning.
Does that include McDonald's?
No. I don't put in fast food places or hot dog stands in gas stations and snowball stands and things like that. These are real restaurants that do real cooking, serve and cook on the premises.
So, Carrie, Willie Mae Scotch House was destroyed, basically, in the storm, and there was a great effort to rebuild the restaurant. How is your business doing now?
Oh, we're doing very well. It's greatly increased since before Katrina.
Your restaurant is in the Treme neighborhood. That's the oldest settlement of free people of color. It's a very historic neighborhood, a very tight-knit community. Are people coming back to the community there? Are you getting local people coming into the restaurant?
Yes, we have a lot of locals. We also have a lot of tourists, but we do have a lot of locals.
Tori McPhail at the Commander's Palace, how's your shrimp and tasso henequen?
I'll tell you what, we sell more of those now than ever. It's a fantastic dish and certainly one of my favorites.
Yum. So there was a lot of sort of emotional need for these restaurants to reopen in New Orleans. Wouldn't you say it's not really surprising that you're, in some sense, on the leading edge of the business redevelopment? Tori?
Yeah, I would agree. I think we could certainly say that. And Commander's Palaces have been around for about 130 years. And it's always been one of those restaurants that has been supported by the locals. And it's one of those places where people come and sit down for their birthdays and their anniversaries and their special occasions. And so when you take that special connection to a place like Commander's Palace away for 13 months, it kind of leaves the soul a little empty. And so once we finally did open back up, you know, people really said, man, thank you so much for providing that great turtle soup or the bread pudding souffle. You know, life just kind of fell a little bit back into normal at that point.
It may not be surprising that the restaurants are coming back, but Tom, what is surprising is that we now have more restaurants open than we did pre-Katrina, right?
That's right. We have about 200 more than before the storm. And I think that's no coincidence. I think that when we were starting to put the city back together again, people wanted to see restaurants more than anybody would have imagined. It was really touch and go. Nobody was sure what was going to happen here right after the storm. And I think the fact that so many restaurants did reopen is one of the big factors that really did repopulate the city to the point where we're on the verge of having population parity with what we had before the storm, too.
Tom, we've been talking to people all week from New Orleans, and a lot of people have said this in different spheres in the business sector in New Orleans, that really Katrina was an opportunity to get rid of some old, maybe bad stuff and to really move forward in a kind of opportunistic entrepreneurial spirit. Once the grieving is over, we saw that in the educational sector and some people were talking about that in terms of small business development. Do you think restaurants have benefited from a kind of a clean slate, an entrepreneurial new leaf?
In a way, but you know what's funny is that it seems to me pretty clear that culinarily speaking, people actually backed up a bit. There was a kind of an almost nutty forward motion in terms of creating new dishes and using new ingredients and all of that kind of went away for a while. And I think it's still not to where it was before. And I think that's a good thing because this is a city that doesn't get its reputation for food by doing what everybody else does a little bit better, but by doing what only we do. This is a very localized cuisine.
So, Tori, how about the day-to-day business in terms of getting supplies, taking care of the business end of your restaurant? Is that as easy or is it more difficult?
These days, since we've updated all of our local farmers list, updated all of our purveyors, updated the list of all of our local shrimpers, it's fine. But it is pretty heartbreaking to be able to see the guys that, you know, are pouring their blood, sweat, and tears out on their shrimp boats, not have all that business come back. It's a little heartbreaking.
And Carrie Seaton, as you're in that Treme neighborhood, looking around the neighborhood, and you said there are locals, but mostly tourists coming into your restaurant. Do you think your restaurant has recovered faster than the neighborhood? Is the neighborhood going to flourish along with you?
It appears to be. It's heavily populated. There aren't any schools open in the area. Well, that's maybe about 1 mile away. There is a high school, but there aren't any elementary schools right now. And there's some new development coming along with some more housing. But it did help the heartbeat of the neighborhood come back. So we were one of the first people back. And then more residents started moving back in and coming back when they saw the restaurant there. So it did help a lot.
And Tori, with your employees, did you get back a lot of those who had worked at the Commander's Palace before? Are you seeing people coming in looking for work?
We are certainly seeing a lot of folks coming in from the different parts of the country. Commander's is a fairly large restaurant, and right before Hurricane Katrina, our kitchen staff measured about 50 of us. Dressed in white and doing the thing. And then after the storm, we had three cooks come back. And so our big thing was to try to take one of the nation's best restaurants, rip it down to the studs, and then return it to the top of the heap using brand-new employees. And so what we actually did is we had this thing called Aqua Blue U. And we basically locked ourselves in a room for literally 4 days, and we taught 50 brand-new cooks, sous chefs, chef de partie is exactly the history of Louisiana food, what it's taken to get us where we're at today, and we really start to march forward into evolving the next evolution of New Orleans food.
Tori McPhail is the executive chef at the famed Commander's Palace. Carrie Seaton operates Willie Mae's Scotch House. And Tom Fitzmaurice hosts the food show on WWL Radio in New Orleans. Thank you all for joining us.
And thanks for making me hungry. Boy, this morning we're also getting advice from all of you on what you're doing to prepare for the swine flu.
My name is Nathan Jeffries. I'm from Lubbock, Texas, and we just need to wash our hands, and that will prevent 90% of everything.
The president has his advice. He's encouraging people to take 3 to 5 days off if they get sick. Easier said than done. Tom emails us, "Dear Mr. President, I would send this to him. Would you please make the following public statement? Encourage employers not to fire employees who stay home from work because they're experiencing flu symptoms. Also, encourage employers to fire employees who do come to work while sick.
Ooh.
Lastly, would you please stay in bed, Mr. President, for a day and do your job from there? This would send a clear message to the nation." I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.